So, in the Gospel of Matthew, in chapter 16, we had really what's kind of the center point of the Gospel. It's the climax of the first half of Matthew's Gospel, and that's where the disciples voiced their final and settled commitment to follow Jesus, right? Their lives were now his. You remember, this is where it happened outside of Caesarea Philippi when Jesus asked, "And who do you say that I am?" And then right after that, Jesus dropped the bomb on them, right? That big shocker, telling them the plan. Now that they're on board and on the team, he shows them what the plan is and tells them plainly that he's going to go to Jerusalem, hand himself over to their enemies, and die. Essentially, when the one who is going to the cross says, "Follow me," it means that all of life, if they're going to be his disciples, if they're going to walk with him as he walks to the cross, then all of life will now be cross-shaped, right? Or the fancier word, cruciform. The self-denial, the sacrifice of the cross is going to be stamped on everything. There's going to be nothing, no part of life that isn't somehow marked by the cross. Jesus has assembled a group of people who he said are going to be the foundation stones of this new people of God, and their interaction with one another will be founded on cross-shaped principles, right? The people who follow Jesus will, out of necessity, see life through cross-shaped lenses, right? And they will live in cross-shaped ways. And so this new cruciform community is the primary theme of chapters 17 through 20, okay? This kind of block, we've seen that Matthew kind of has these big thematic blocks. And this block, 17 through 20, is basically about discipleship, right? The forming of a new community that functions differently from the world that these people have been drawn out of. Forming newly committed followers into a people who will be easily recognized as they were with Jesus. So chapter 18 is one of Matthew's five discourses. It's the fourth of the five. And it is a discourse about how this community of disciples will operate. And then next week, we'll see chapters 19 and 20 are teaching and events that illustrate the principles of this new community. So as I've been doing with most of these sermons on kind of fairly long passages so that we're not in the Gospel of Matthew for like several years, we're going to take it in sections and not addressing everything, right? You know, there'll be lots of things that you wish that I had said something about, but you know, that's why we have email, that's why we have telephones, that's why we have mingling after the service, so feel free to ask about those things. But instead, we're just going to try to trace the development of this main idea about discipleship and about the forming of this cross-shaped community. So we're going to start with Matthew 18, 1 through 10. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" He called a little child to him and placed the child among them. And he said, "Truly, I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever takes the lowly position of this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. Woe to the world because of the things that cause people to stumble. Such things must come, but woe to the person through whom they come. If your hand or foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life maimed or crippled than to have two hands or two feet and be thrown into eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into the fire of hell. See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that their angels in heaven always see the face of my Father in heaven. The word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God.
So the disciples come and they ask, who is the greatest in the kingdom? And like I said last week, people love to kind of pick on Peter, and this is another place where people pick on the disciples and say, ugh, what an awful question, what an unchristian question. How can they ask this? How can they be thinking? How can they be so worldly still? But, you know, to us as modern Christians who've lived with 2,000 years with humility as this virtue, it seems like an odd question, but it really isn't. It's a good question. And really, when we kind of think it's so immodest of them to ask, we also have to remember that we are not all that different. Modern-day Christians have simply kind of learned to hide all of that pride and ambition behind some habits that are mostly just cultural habits of what you say and don't say. But inside, we're pretty much the same. And so this cheeky question is actually a good question, right? What should we be striving towards? Who's mostly getting it right? Right? Who do we look at to take a good example? We would never say, who is greatest? But we understand the motivation, and it's a good idea when a company puts up a picture of employee of the month. Right? You want to recognize the people who are making the right decisions, and you want to hold out to others that, see, this is the thing that we want you doing. And to answer, Jesus puts a small child in the middle of the circle. So, first of all, let's set aside what Jesus is not talking about when he holds out a small child as an example. A child can conjure up lots of ideas of innocence and purity, kindness, and selflessness. You wouldn't believe the long history of preachers dealing with children in exactly that way. And somebody remarked that one of the reasons is probably because most of the early church fathers were celibate and didn't have children, right? Wouldn't it be wonderful if we were all as kind and as innocent, as selfless as children, right? Said no parent ever. Don't get me wrong, today's Father's Day, right? I have five. They are wonderful. I love my children. I would do anything for children. It is the greatest honor of my life to have laid down my life to provide for them. I sanctify myself for their sake. We love our children. And they are very, very innocent for like 2 weeks, right? And they were no more angelic in Jesus' day than they are now. And Jesus does not tell us to become good or kind like children, right? He says specifically that we need to be humbled like children. Also, when he speaks of humility, he's not talking about modesty, okay? Those are very similar ideas, and it's easy to confuse the two, especially because when we talk about humility, what we're really talking about is more often probably modesty. Modesty is being quiet about yourself, right? Not putting yourself or your abilities on display, holding back a little bit of proper reserve, right? And modesty is a good thing, but this is not what Jesus is talking about. When Jesus speaks about humility, and when he says that you need to be humbled, and it's actually passive like that in the Greek, to be humbled. A little bit more of a little edge there, right? Being humbled is being lowered or actively taking a lower rung on the social scale. The disciples asked, how do you take a step up? And Jesus says, you need to take a step down. Okay? So children in the ancient world had no social status. Okay? They had no rights. They had no voice. Their needs were not taken into account, even often in the family. The children's needs were an afterthought, if that. Okay? Nowadays, right, there's no better way to pull on heartstrings than to put a picture on TV of abandoned, needy children. But in the ancient world of Rome or Greece, if they had been confronted with a problem that children somewhere are suffering or starving or the police are hunting them down at night in Brazil, the response would have been, well, goodness, just get rid of them. If they're a problem, get rid of them. Which is what they actually often did. If a child was sickly or disabled, if a child was not the right gender, if a child was merely inconvenient, they would get rid of it. Children were at the very bottom of the consideration of what is worth. We actually, from the if what I said sounds shocking and it's hard to believe, we have lots of letters from the ancient world, right? We have like correspondence between like a Roman wife and her husband who's like serving in some other province, right? And she writes a letter, "Oh, I had a child the other day," or I'm expecting. And the husband writes back, "Oh, okay, well, you know, if it's a girl, just get rid of it, you know, just." So when Jesus sets a child in front of them, he's showing the disciples not a picture of like what humanity is supposed to be, right? Pure and clean and cheerful. He's showing the disciples a picture of helplessness, of low status, the one who has no worth, the one who rightfully expects to get the leftovers after the more important ones have been taken care of. The standard of greatness in the ancient world was Alexander the Great. Okay, you learned about him in history class, and one of the things that you may not have picked up is how hugely influential he was in the ancient world. In the ancient world, everyone who was anyone was trying to compare themselves to Alexander the Great in one way or another. And he proved his greatness by conquering, by dominating, by taking the first share, by laying his hand on the best and saying, "This is mine. You all can have the leftovers." And Jesus says here that greatness now has to be cross-shaped. Because if they follow the one who willingly goes to the cross for others, then the one who is great will not dominate others, but will yield to others. Won't take for his own good, but will give for others' good. She won't take a step up the ladder and get first dibs. She will take a step down the ladder in order to let others get theirs first. Now, it's important to note that this humility is not about how you see yourself. Humility is not about having your bubble popped, although a lot of us need our bubbles popped regularly, right? It's not about having a low opinion of yourself. This humility is about seeing and appreciating the other person. It isn't really about taking a step down the ladder as though we're aiming for a society where everybody's at the bottom of the barrel. It's about lifting everyone else up a rung. Humility isn't about a lack of honor. Humility is about giving honor to others, honoring and valuing whoever is right there in front of you, and yielding to the other as a way of honoring and valuing, of lifting up the other, is the mark of the great in the kingdom. Not because they are forced to yield out of weakness, but because they choose to yield for the good of the other. Now, when you get our minds focused on this, when you kind of get, so often in Scripture, when you get on the right track, then you see that the track just flows forward, and what follows just makes sense. And when you get your minds focused on this idea of humility here, the next section, next several sections of the text just kind of flow naturally out of it, right? In the section that we read, Jesus talks about receiving little ones, which means to give our time and attention to those who are unimportant or unseen, right? The ones that society doesn't value or pay attention to. And then he goes on and talks about not causing others to stumble, which can mean causing others to sin, but it can also more generally mean simply causing others to lose their way, to get lost, or to trip up in life, to fall in between the cracks. Now, if humility is about innocence or thinking less of yourself, then these topics of receiving the little ones or not causing others to stumble would appear to be almost unrelated. But if the main idea is about valuing and lifting up and honoring others around you, then caring for others by receiving them and making sure with whatever's within your power, making sure that they're set up to succeed, well, that's exactly what humility does. Sees and takes care of the others around. And then after the portion that we read, we have the parable about the shepherd, right, who leaves the 99 to go find the one who wandered. From the standpoint of a community, the loss of one is negligible. But the community that sees Jesus' cross as the pattern for everything it does doesn't think about what the loss of one means for the community, because it sees and values the one, such that the natural thing is to take on the cost in order to go and rescue that one. And then after the parable, we have probably what's the most famous bit of chapter 18, which is what you do with someone who is in the wrong. First, you try to help them understand what they're doing, that it's wrong. If they do not listen, you quietly bring in a few others. And there the point is not that they'll back you up and witness to the fact that you're right and he's wrong. The idea is it's help other voices to get the person to see and understand what it is that they're doing. And if that doesn't work, then you bring in the entire community to say, we do not agree and we cannot walk closely together with you if you insist on this. Now, as always, there is a ton that can be said about that passage. But in context, what it actually is it's actually an example, an illustration, a real-life picture of what going after that one sheep in the wilderness is about. This is actually an explanation, an example, of the parable of the 99 and the one sheep. When someone begins to wander from the way of following Jesus, the one who sees life through a cross-shaped lens is willing to take the time and trouble to do what he can to help even the most difficult and willful to get back to following Jesus. Too often we read that passage about, you know, if your brother disagrees with you, as this is how you can vindicate yourself. This is how you can win the battle in a Christian way. And it's not. It's all about the brother. Matter of fact, the words there where it says, if a brother sins against you, the words against you are actually very much in question whether they were in the original or not. It's possible that what Jesus actually said is, if a brother sins, and that it's not about you at all. It's about seeing a brother wandering and thinking, this is not okay. Jesus died for that brother. What can I do to help him get back? It's not about conflict management. And then finally, the two short things wrap up this whole section on humility. First of all, Jesus repeats the words that he said earlier to Peter about sharing in God's authority, right? Whatever you bind, whatever you loose. Except here the single you has become the plural you all. And then he also says that wherever even two of them meet together and yield to one another, he is present. Okay? This new cross-shaped community will be the place where God is present, and it will be the place where God is at work, bringing about his will on earth. So the first half of the chapter is actually, it looks like all these splintered different stories that Matthew just kind of stuck together, because where else are you going to put it, right? But it turns out the first half of the chapter is all about humility. And then the second half is all about forgiveness. Like the first half, it begins with a question that the disciples ask. But here the answer, instead of all this different stuff, is just one long parable that speaks pretty powerfully for itself. This is, from verse, I have the wrong page open there. First, probably 21, I'm guessing.
21, 23.
Yes, thank you. Then Peter came to Jesus and asked, "Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Up to seven times?" Again, we often think that, Peter's trying to find a loophole to get out of all this forgiveness, right? But probably not. There's evidence in the writing of rabbis a little bit later to think that the right answer in Jesus' day, because these were the kind of questions that people were discussing, right? The right answer in Jesus' day was that you should forgive three times. This was kind of the opinion of the rabbis. Okay, like I said, the evidence for that is a little bit later, but usually by the time something gets written down, it's been around for a while. Three times. After that, you're not helping the person by forgiving them at all. Okay? After that, if a person is persisting in their sin after forgiving them three times, then the person is really at fault and needs to be helped with punishment. Now, if this is the case, then Peter's question doesn't mean that Peter's looking for an out, but it means that Peter probably is beginning to catch on to Jesus' radical views about forgiveness. And then, if you remember that the number seven is very frequently used symbolically to mean perfection or continually or like to no end, then Peter's probably saying something like, "Wow, Jesus. So, like, there's never a time that we give up on someone? You want us to always forgive, don't you?" And Jesus answered, "I tell you, not seven times, but 77 times." Okay? So if we understood Peter's question right, then Jesus is not correcting Peter. "Oh, selfish Peter, not just seven times." No. Peter, Jesus is saying, "Yeah, Peter. Yeah, you get it. And guess what?" And Jesus goes on to refer to a verse from Genesis 4. Okay? You may remember that there in the middle of a genealogy, a man named Lamech boasted. He said, "I have killed a man simply for wounding me. I've killed a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times." Okay? So earlier in the chapter, God had promised to avenge Cain completely. Cain was afraid that because of his sin, that anyone who found him could kill him. And God said, "No, I'm going to mark you. And if anyone kills you, I will avenge you seven times." Okay? Seven times over there, again, being symbolic for completely. I will totally avenge you. And here, Lamech boasts that he will not only have full vengeance, but that he will go over the top. That he will joyfully abound in vengeance. That vengeance will be his identity, and that he will swim in it with no limit, no restraint. And so Jesus is saying, "Yeah, Peter, there's never a time when you don't forgive. But I want you to delight in it. I want you to make forgiveness your identity. I want you to joyfully swim in that forgiveness. I want you to overwhelm people with the extent of your forgiveness, knowing no limit, no restraint. When someone hurt Lamech, they were met with a tsunami of vengeance. And Jesus is saying, when people hurt you, they will unleash a tsunami of forgiveness. And then the parable. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. As he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 bags of gold, or in the older translations, 10,000 talents. Incidentally, 10,000 is the largest number that you can say in Greek, and a talent is the largest measurement. So Jesus is combining these two things to basically say an astronomical number, right? It's like a little kid saying, I want a gazillion dollars, right? There's no such thing as a gazillion, okay? He owed him this astronomical amount. Since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. At this, the servant fell on his knees before him. Be patient with me, he begged, and I will pay back everything. A ludicrous claim. The servant's master took pity on him, canceled the debt, and let him go. But when that servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 silver coins. He grabbed him and began to choke him. Pay back what you owe me, he demanded. His fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him, be patient with me and I will pay it back. But he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could pay the debt. When the other servants saw what had happened, they were outraged and went and told their master everything that had happened. Then the master called the servant in. You wicked servant, he said. I canceled all that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you? In anger, his master handed him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all he owed. This is how my heavenly Father will treat each of you unless you forgive your brother or sister from your heart. So you could say that humility and forgiveness are the two beams of the cross, right, that stamp its image on those who follow Jesus. And so the fellowship of those who follow Jesus as he goes to the cross to give his life for others' good will always be a cross-shaped community, unmistakably marked by humility, which is an eagerness to lift up others, and forgiveness, an eagerness to forgive beyond all measure. Amen.